Welcome to GI Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. Dr. David Ilson seems to be involved in almost every aspect of GI oncology, and I met with the professor for his take on some of the recent highlights, beginning with cancer of the esophagus.
Esophageal cancer, you have the potential of identifying a premalignant precursor, you know, with the reflux and Barrett's-associated disease, which accounts for about two-thirds of cases. And I think there have been interesting developments in ablative strategies of treating Barrett's esophagus. Previously, we just put patients on antacids and watched them and would monitor them for dysplasia. And patients progressed to high-grade dysplasia. They might even get surgery, you know, prophylactic esophagectomy. And there are newer ablative strategies endoscopically, radiofrequency ablation, where dysplastic Barrett's may potentially be ablated earlier on. I think it still remains in its early development, but some of the preliminary data suggest that it might be a useful way to actually eradicate Barrett's and potentially dysplasia. In terms of early stage esophageal cancer, for very superficial tumors, tumors that just invade the mucosa lining, there also is a potential for endoscopic therapy rather than surgery. Endoscopic mucosal resection for tumors that are staged what we call T1A. T1A is very superficial mucosal invasion. T1A, very low risk of lymph node involvement. So these are patients, they're essentially, you know, T1 and zero, that you do endoscopic resection without surgery. And it's a procedure essentially without a mortality. When you start to get into more invasive T1B, where you get penetration into the muscularis mucosa, then generally surgery is required because then you start getting nodal involvement. I think there is now pretty much standard adoption for T3 or node-positive disease that some form of preoperative treatment should be given. Some believe chemotherapy alone is a preoperative strategy based on gastric cancer trials, based on the MAGIC trial, which showed a survival benefit for pre- and postoperative ECF chemotherapy. Most cancer centers in the U.S. endorse chemotherapy and radiation as a preoperative treatment. And two recent studies from Europe that give weight to that approach. One was actually a head-to-head comparison done in Germany, very carefully staged patients, endoscopic ultrasound, laparoscopically staged patients, high-risk T3-4 disease of the distal esophagus, GE junction, and cardia, randomly assigned to get 3 months of chemotherapy alone followed by surgery versus combined chemotherapy and radiation followed by surgery. It was a small, underpowered study, but nonetheless showed much higher rates of pathologic complete response with chemo and radiation, was like 16% versus 2% for chemotherapy alone. Many more patients on the chemo radiation arm had node-negative disease, which we know that's one of the key prognostic factors for a good outcome, is that a patient's node-negative at the time of surgery. 64% for chemo-rads versus only 37% for chemo alone. And there were significant trends towards better survival for chemo radiation. The second trial that I think emphasized the value of preoperative chemo and radiation was a Dutch trial presented at ASCO back in June from Gast and colleagues from the Netherlands. It was a 366-patient randomized trial. Again, endoscopically ultrasound stage patients with a mixture of adeno and squamous cancers, but 75% of the patients had T3 node-positive disease, 75% were adenocarcinoma. Randomized trial, surgery alone, versus a more modern chemotherapy, carboplatin, paclitaxel, radiation, weekly chemotherapy, easy to administer, well-tolerated, well-established in non-small cell lung cancer. And carboplatin, paclitaxel, radiation led to a two-year median survival improvement, a 25% higher rate of curative resection compared to surgery alone, and about a 10 to 15% incremental improvements in survival out to 3 years. So many of us feel that that large, well-conducted, randomized trial establishes chemotherapy and radiation as an acceptable standard of care for patients with squamous and adenocarcinoma, and that a modern chemotherapy regimen that's easy to administer, well-tolerated carboplatin paclitaxel, could be administered by community physicians, often used to treat non-small cell lung cancer with radiation. And actually, many of our upcoming research studies are building on this. There's a HER2-directed study in esophageal and GE junction cancers that will use weekly carboplatin paclitaxel and radiation. We'll screen the patients. This is being run through RTOG, test patients for HER2 positivity, which is about 20% of patients. If they're HER2 positive, then they'll be randomized to chemotherapy and radiation with or without trastuzumab. So Why trastuzumab? Well, it turns out in metastatic esophageal gastric cancer, again, recently published study, the TOGA trial, which was a global trial in HER2-positive esophageal gastric cancer, they actually screened 3,800 patients to identify ultimately about 600 patients that were randomized on the study, HER2-positive by either FISH or immunohistochemistry. And patients were randomized to get mostly capecitabine cisplatinum versus capecitabine cisplatinum plus trastuzumab. And this trial, published in Lancet Oncology, showed significant benefits in response rate, progression-free survival, and the primary endpoint, overall survival, was achieved, nearly a three-month improvement in overall survival. So as a consequence of this trial, the FDA has approved the use of trastuzumab in HER2-positive G-junction and gastric cancers in the first-line chemotherapy treatment of metastatic disease. So that's an interesting and exciting new development in targeted therapy in metastatic disease. And now that's led, engendered an adjuvant trial in esophagus cancer, randomizing HER2-positive patients to get or not get trastuzumab as part of chemoradiation.
So before you go on, wow, that's a lot of stuff. Let me backtrack through a few of those things. Maybe I'll go in reverse order. The issue of frequency of HER2 positivity is something oncologists have a lot of questions about. Of course, they don't see that many patients. Some of them say, I've never seen anybody's HER2 positive. Your group had a report at ASCO looking at this in your population. What did you report, and how does this vary geographically and by the type of cancer?
Yeah, I think for more distal gastric cancers, the rate of positivity is about 16%. For the proximal G-junction tumors, it's as high as 20 to 25%. There are some differences in gastric and breast cancer staining. It tends to be more spotty in gastric cancer. There have been proposals of different screening systems. How do you score positivity on immunohistochemistry? And also, there's an indication that more diffuse gastric cancers are only 5% positive compared to more of the intestinal variety of gastric cancer, which is the 16% positivity. So there are differences in subtypes of gastric cancer. For esophagus and GE junction tumors, they tend to be the intestinal type. And again, the rate of positivity for the proximal gastric cancers, GE junction tumors, is higher. But overall, we expect about a 15 to 20% positivity rate, either with FISH or immunohistochemistry.
And I guess you all reported 21% positivity, which is right in there. What about the type of HER2 testing in breast cancer? There has been a lot of interest in FISH, and Slayman and his group, that's mainly what they use. Others go through the typical algorithm of IHC first. What do we know about this in gastric cancer? Particularly, what do we know about the 0 and 1 plus IHC that are FISH positive?
Well, our paradigm at Memorial Sloan Kettering is if a patient's IHC 3 plus positive, we don't bother to do FISH because it's almost always positive. And if patients are IHC negative, we tend to accept that because very few of those patients are going to be FISH positive. So the ends of the spectrum, IHC 0, we would tend to accept as a real finding. The IHC 3 plus, we wouldn't bother to do FISH. It's the intermediate patients, the 1, 2 plus, that we might consider FISH testing. The actual FDA approved indication for trastuzumab in esophageal gastric cancer is either FISH positive or immunohistochemistry 3 plus. So there was a little more liberal approval for the use of the drug. And that actually accounted for the majority of patients on the trial.
I actually ran into a hospital in New Jersey we were working with on an education program, and they just send it for FISH. Do you think that's acceptable?
Well, again, most of the IHC 3 plus are going to be FISH positive. You could argue it both ways. Some patients are FISH positive only and immunonegative. They're rare subgroups, so I think it's still a debatable issue. The RTOG trial is actually going to mandate only FISH positivity rather than the immuno.
I get the feeling that there's not a small amount of confusion in pathologists about how to do IHC testing. Is that your take?
Yeah, well, IHC is very subjective. I mean, it's read by the pathologist. There are proposals for different scoring systems with gastric and breast cancers, but that's really more the realm of the pathologist and not the medical oncologist.
Now, you talked about the study that's looking at the neoadjuvant setting. Do you think it's acceptable in some situations to utilize that strategy outside a protocol setting right now?
Neoadjuvant treatment is the standard of care, I think.
I'm talking about trastuzumab.
No, I don't think that using a targeted agent outside of a clinical trial should be used.
What about the use of cetuximab and gastroesophageal cancer? You were part of a report from the CALGB and an ECOG looking in the metastatic setting. What did that show, and what about combining it with chemoradiation?
Yeah, I think cetuximab is a promising targeted agent. The EGF receptor is overexpressed in about 80 to 90% of esophagogastric cancers. Although the EGF-targeted drugs don't have single-agent activity in esophagogastric cancer, it's virtually nil. Phase 2 data did show potentially improvements in response and time to progression. The randomized CLGB trial, 80403, was a randomized phase 2 trial, three different chemotherapy regimens with cetuximab. So the primary endpoint was actually response rate on this trial. And it turned out, in a head-to-head comparison of FOLFOX, ECF, and weekly irinotecan cisplatin, the irinotecan cisplatin arm actually had the lowest response, the lowest progression-free survival, and the lowest overall survival, and the greatest rate of toxicity. So I think we established that that regimen should not be used first line. Irinotecan-based treatment should probably be used second line. In the comparison of FOLFOX and ECF, they were really shown to be quite similar. So there really was no evidence from that study that adding a third drug, epirubicin, improved the efficacy of chemotherapy, and there was more toxicity in the ECF cetuximab arm compared to cetuximab FOLFOX. There was perhaps a signal. Response rates were all in the mid-50% range, and the progression-free survivals approached 6 months, overall survival about 11 months. Standard chemotherapy, you get response rates in the 30% range, progression-free survivals 4 to 5 months. So there is a signal that there might be some modest improvement. There are ongoing phase 3 trials of cetuximab in Europe. There is the EXPAND trial, which is looking at capecitabine cisplatin with or without cetuximab. That's a randomized phase 3 trial, which is accruing over 400 patients, and it's near accrual.
This is metastatic disease?
Metastatic disease. And the other metastatic disease trial in Europe is REAL-3. That's being conducted in the UK, where they're looking at ECX, which is epirubicin, cisplatin, capecitabine, with or without panitumumab in advanced esophagogastric cancer. That trial is also accruing. And then the third randomized trial is looking at lapatinib, which is the multi-targeted, the HER1, HER2 tyrosine kinase inhibitor, capecitabine, oxaliplatin, with or without lapatinib. The LOGIC trial is ongoing. So I think we'll get hopefully an answer within the next year or two in a phase 3 setting about the efficacy of cetuximab in metastatic esophagogastric cancer. In terms of chemoradiation, we've gotten kind of mixed signals from different studies. There was a pilot study from the University of Maryland and Brown looking at carboplatin, paclitaxel, cetuximab radiation. It was feasible. So there's now a randomized trial ongoing through RTOG looking at cisplatin, paclitaxel radiation with or without cetuximab in locally advanced esophageal cancer. So there is phase 3 trial already ongoing. It's accrued about 200 patients. It's a non-surgical trial. It's really geared for patients that are non-operative candidates.
Any predictions?
Too early to say, but it's accrued about half of the patients. Then we got some toxicity signals. There was an ECOG trial that combined 5-FU oxaliplatin, cetuximab, and radiation, and they had toxic deaths in about 25% of patients, pulmonary complications, suggesting that there was some toxicity signal with oxaliplatin, cetuximab, and radiation. However, other studies looking at EGF-targeted antibodies in phase 2, there's an ACOSOG trial ongoing with docetaxel, cisplatin, panitumumab radiation pre-op. They've not apparently seen a toxicity signal. And there's an ongoing trial, there's actually several ongoing trials in Europe. In the UK, capecitabine platinum radiation with or without cetuximab in non-operative candidates is ongoing. They've not closed the trial due to toxicity, but patients don't get surgery. And then there's a Swiss trial looking at docetaxel cisplatin with or without cetuximab. Their phase 2 experience, they did not have untoward toxic deaths. So we've got a mixed signal. I think most of the studies have suggested it's safe to combine an EGF antibody with chemoradiation, and we really have to await completion of phase 3 trials to see whether there's an improvement in survival with these novel agents.
When you mentioned lapatinib, it reminded me that I was just actually interviewing your colleague Cliff Huddis the other day about all the new anti-HER agents that are coming out, T-DM1, pertuzumab. Lapatinib's already out there. Any interest in looking at these agents in HER2-positive gastric cancer?
Yeah, I think there's a clear interest because there's a parallel. I mean, 20% of esophagogastric cancer is positive, 20% breast cancer is positive for HER2. So the problem is the commonality of the disease. Esophagogastric cancer is relatively rare. It's somewhat of an orphan disease for new drug development. We rely on governmental agencies and also industry to support study of these new drugs. And I suspect that if these drugs move forward, and other disease types that we'll be seeing trials of these agents in esophagogastric cancer. And I did mention the ongoing LOGIC trial of lapatinib, which is the global randomized trial already. But I think there's given a suggestion of potential increased efficacy with these antibody toxin conjugates, the merit study in esophagogastric cancer that's HER2 positive.
I guess it also brings up the question of how much evidence do we need in order to take action. There are HER2 positive tumors and other cancers that are much less common, lung cancer, ovarian cancer, et cetera. Do you think we're going to come to a point at which, you know, we'll treat without necessarily trial data in specific tumors based on markers like this?
I really don't think so, because different cancers behave different ways. For instance, EGF tyrosine kinase inhibitors are active in non-small cell lung cancers that harbor EGF mutations. These drugs are inactive in esophagogastric cancer, and the incidence of EGF mutations approaches zero. So I think that there was hope that we were going to be able to profile tumors more on their molecular profile rather than the site of origin. But I think even with these different pathways affected in different solid tumors, they're clearly activated and cause tumor progression and growth in very different ways. So that I think we're still going to be living with the paradigm of treating breast cancers, lung cancers, not just treating all HER2 positive tumors the same way. And as I said, you know, we can't extrapolate yet that we're going to see an adjuvant benefit for trastuzumab and HER2 positive esophagogastric cancer until we do proof of principle.
I saw that you were part of a paper that came out of the NCCN looking at the utility of PET scanning in a variety of tumor types. What did you all conclude?
Well, I think there are some cancers that PET clearly has value in staging and potentially in the research arena and response assessment. In other tumors, it appeared, you know, is it clearly adding benefit? I think there was notable increased use of PET scan in prostate cancer, for example. It's not clear whether that imaging adds more beyond than what's done conventionally. Some cancers have low rates of PET positivity. You know, gastric cancer, up to a third of patients, their tumors are PET negative, so you do a test and a third of the time the tumor may not even light up on a PET scan. So I think the conclusion was that in diseases where we have evidence that it enhances staging and changes treatment, then it should be a staging procedure that continues to be used. I think as a research tool, certainly in esophagogastric cancer, it's being looked at in controlled studies in the U.S. CLGB is going to be opening a trial in esophageal G junction cancers looking at PET scan. It's an expensive technology. So, and as we're trying to contain costs, we want to use this technology when we think it's most appropriate. It's going to help guide management. And when we think it's not going to add much above conventional imaging with CAT scan, then I'd say it probably shouldn't be used.
Actually, we had your colleagues Andy Zelenitz and Steve Horowitz down in our place in Miami doing a think tank on NHL. And of course, one of the topics that came up there was interim PET scanning and diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. Again, thinking about this group that kind of reviewed the whole field, any other areas where interim PET scanning seems to be valuable?
Well, I think, again, we're looking at a research question whether early PET scan during induction treatment can help identify early treatment failures and potentially offer those patients alternative therapy to try and improve outcome.
With neoadjuvant treatment?
With neoadjuvant treatment.
Makes sense.
And it's already clearly established in staging. You know, PET scan in both esophageal and gastric cancer will identify 15% of patients that have distant metastatic disease that's not appreciated from conventional staging. So, and that's a significant percentage of patients that would be spared surgery and radiation, local treatments that aren't going to help them if they already have stage 4 disease.
You had a paper at ASCO on sorafenib, which kind of surprised me. You saw a couple of good responses.
Yeah, I mean, I don't like to get too excited about early phase 2 data. Sorafenib, we know, is a drug that's used now to treat renal cell and hepatocellular cancer, two of the most chemotherapy-resistant cancers. And the benefit of sorafenib in these diseases is mostly disease stabilization rather than response. So this engendered an interest for us to look at this multi-targeted tyrosine kinase inhibitor in metastatic esophageal and GE junction cancers. And we may be observing a signal of stable disease in this trial, but we want to complete it. It's always provocative when you see a response to a new drug, but that has been often the case with many agents that in further study didn't move forward. But the data for sorafenib is provocative, and I think it's a drug that may be pursued further, perhaps in combination with chemotherapy.
you know, a lot of targeted agents get tested with chemo and you can't really figure out exactly what's going on. But, you know, when you see a targeted agent given by itself, I mean, you had a patient who had a complete response. And I know it's anecdotal, but it's pretty interesting.
Oh, yeah. No, we're fascinated by this. And once we complete the study, can this agent be looked at in combination with neoadjuvant treatment? Would it be a potential adjuvant strategy? Because I think another thing we discussed at the meeting, one of the presentations I gave yesterday, is that we have established neoadjuvant treatments, but they really only help a minority of patients. Most of our patients are not going to benefit from currently available therapy. And we have a group of patients, they go through chemotherapy, radiation, and surgery, they still have significant residual disease. Those are patients that are not likely to do well with their conventional treatment. And it's also an ideal patient population. They're high risk for recurrence that would be candidates for novel investigative therapies, looking at a targeted agent, looking at perhaps a change in chemotherapy. So there are discussions amongst my colleagues to try and potentially tailor trials to this high-risk group of patients who right now we, aside from observation, once they've completed all their treatment, we really don't have a good treatment strategy.
I was chatting with another of your colleagues, Eileen. Now that I think about it, I'm talking to your colleagues all the time, it seems like. And I was chatting with Eileen O'Reilly about pancreatic cancer. Anything you want to say about that?
Pancreatic cancer is a very difficult disease to treat. I mean, only a minority of patients are candidates for curative surgery. I think we have made progress. We do know that surgery in combination with adjuvant chemotherapy improves survival modestly. I think we have made modest improvements in systemic chemotherapy treating metastatic disease, the advent of a drug like erlotinib, improving one-year survival. Now a suggestion that combination chemotherapy, a regimen like FOLFIRINOX, the first phase 3 trial of chemotherapy to actually show a survival benefit in pancreatic cancer in nearly 20 years. So I think we are developing modestly more effective systemic chemotherapy to treat patients with pancreatic cancer. I think patients are living longer. And I think in the targeted arena, other than erlotinib, screening of drugs like bevacizumab and cetuximab did not yield a benefit in metastatic disease. And we're looking at a whole host of new agents, PARP inhibitors, other more specifically targeted agents, to see whether we can get a signal of some benefit in patients. But it still remains a huge health challenge, again, with a minority of patients that are candidates for curative surgery. We are also now trying to address the issue of whether or not the addition of a targeted agent like erlotinib improves outcome compared to standard adjuvant gemcitabine alone. RTOG has a randomized trial nationally that's also going to be opening in Europe, and this is supported through the intergroup as well by the SWOG cooperative group. After pancreatectomy, patients get randomized to receive standard gemcitabine with or without erlotinib. And I think the RTOG also took the bold step of not only asking the chemotherapy question, but at the end of the adjuvant chemotherapy, there's a second randomization to get or not get adjuvant radiation. So this trial actually will hopefully address two questions. Does a targeted agent that seems to work in metastatic disease contribute any benefit in the adjuvant setting? And does the addition of radiation therapy at the end of adjuvant treatment improve outcome compared to adjuvant chemotherapy alone? This is a huge question because if you look at the trials of adjuvant chemotherapy, I mean, of course, you're comparing across clinical trials, but the survival benefits for adjuvant chemotherapy and radiation seem quite similar to the survival benefits achieved with chemotherapy alone. And the question is, at this point in time, does radiation contribute? So the RTOG trial, I encourage clinicians and investigators around the country to put patients on this adjuvant therapy trial.
You mentioned the FOLFIRINOX study presented at ASCO last year. We get a lot of questions from oncologists about it. You know, they haven't used it or have only used it one or two people. Can you talk about that study, what your impression was, and particularly the issue of tolerability? You know, they called it, quote, relatively well tolerated. And on the other hand, I've heard about cases that it was very unwell tolerated. What's your experience?
Yeah, well, see, I tend to individualize chemotherapy dosing. You have to take into consideration performance status, patient age. And you're not going to give a 70-year-old with metastatic pancreatic cancer full dose FOLFIRINOX. It just makes no clinical sense. We have data from analyses and studies that, yes, older patients benefit from chemotherapy. Older patients should be treated the same way with advanced disease and adjuvant strategies. But we acknowledge that they experience greater toxicity. So acknowledging that, you make dose adjustments. I think the FOLFIRINOX parent regimen is probably too high a dosing. It's essentially giving full-dose FOLFOX with full-dose irinotecan. And most patients don't even tolerate full-dose FOLFOX or FOLFIRI. So trying to give all those drugs together I think is unrealistic, and I think dose adjustments need to be made. Another strategy that I employ in my practice is you don't always have to start patients with all the drugs on the first cycle. You can start the patient with FOLFOX, assess their toxicity, and if they tolerate it, add the irinotecan at the second and third cycle. And that way you've teased out the different components of the treatment. Many practitioners feel they have to follow lockstep published chemotherapy protocols, and clearly we know that chemotherapy is not a one-size-fits-all, and there are ways that you can administer treatment more safely and rationally and individualize dosing to the tolerance of your patient.
Again, in your non-protocol management, how do you decide whether or not to add in erlotinib to gemcitabine?
Up until FOLFIRINOX, erlotinib was the only drug that resulted in a survival benefit in metastatic pancreatic cancer. What FOLFIRINOX did, not only did it improve overall survival, but it tripled response rate, it doubled median survival, and the survival at 1 year went from 20% to 40%. So erlotinib, you got a survival increment of about 6%. So now with the potential for combination chemotherapy regimens, I tend to start, if I have a good performance status patient, I'll start them on a combination chemotherapy regimen first. If they have stable disease or respond to that regimen, then I may include erlotinib later on in treatment, given its potential to add benefit. Right now, we do have benefit that it helps gemcitabine monotherapy. We don't really have data for what it adds to combination treatment in pancreatic cancer. But I do use it selectively in gemcitabine monotherapy, usually adding it later on in the treatment to not, again, subject patients to all the toxicity up front. Whether or not it benefits combination chemotherapy, you know, the drug is approved for gemcitabine-based treatment, and I think it's a consideration to use in selected patients.
Any comments on pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors?
Pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors, a double-edged sword. I mean, they don't respond well to treatment, but patients have a better survival. They tend to be indolent or slow-growing tumors. They also can sometimes have the complication of hormonal production. So, you know, tumors that produce insulin can cause life-threatening hypoglycemia. Tumors that produce vasoactive polypeptides can cause life-threatening diarrhea and dehydration. So the mainstay of treating pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors has been somatostatin analog. This is clearly a drug that seems to have a static effect in these tumors. It also has a biochemical effect in reducing hormone production, probably in more than 80% of patients. So somatostatin analog in a pancreatic islet cell tumor that's metastatic would be considered a frontline treatment. Chemotherapy, streptozotocin-based chemotherapy, has modest effectiveness, response rates in the 10 to 20% range. I think some of the targeted agents are looking quite promising. Recent interesting data for sunitinib and the RAD-001 compound that seems to show improvement in progression-free survival in patients with pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors versus placebo. There is a suggestion that some of these newer targeted agents improve progression-free survival compared to placebo-based treatment.
GIST,
I'm not a sarcoma doctor, but I think GIST is sort of the tumor that we wished all solid tumors behave like. It has one key target, the KIT ligand, and it's when that KIT ligand is mutated, if we find the tyrosine kinase inhibitor that inhibits that pathway, these drugs work dramatically well. You have high rates of response, high rates of disease control. It's also gotten to the point where they can look at specific mutations that patients will more likely respond if they have certain pattern of mutations. We now even have salvage treatments. Patients failing frontline imatinib now respond to sunitinib. That's now an approved second-line treatment. And we heard an interesting abstract presented at this meeting for third-line sorafenib as a potential new drug in the armamentarium to treat these diseases. I think what's come out of randomized trials is that it probably is better, because patients are often on these drugs for a year or 2 years or longer, in patients that continue to respond to therapy with metastatic unresectable disease, it's probably better to continue therapy rather than discontinue it. And in the adjuvant setting, there's provocative data that adjuvant imatinib improves disease-free survival compared to observation, particularly in patients with larger tumors. Patients that have smaller tumors or tumors that have low aggressiveness, like fewer high power fields with mitoses. Those are patients that probably shouldn't get adjuvant imatinib. Patients with larger tumors, more tumors with mitoses per high power field, that's become an approved indication for imatinib as an adjuvant treatment to try and reduce risk of recurrence.
Let's finish on a more common tumor, colorectal cancer. Eric Van Cutsem wrote an editorial in the JCO recently that went along with the negative NSABP adjuvant BEV study. And I came away feeling really depressed that for such a common disease right now, there doesn't seem to really be very much going on in terms of new agents or encouraging ideas.
Well, I don't know if I would say that. I mean, we made a lot of progress in the last 10 years. When I started practicing 20 years ago, all we had was 5-FU, and people lived for 10 months with metastatic disease. Now we have an array of first, second, and third line treatments, and the average survival in patients with metastatic disease exceeding 2 years. We've made significant advances in adjuvant treatment in colorectal cancer. Patients with stage 3 disease, the survival is 50%. Now with adjuvant 5-FU oxaliplatin, the survival is 70-75%. So we've improved survival in the metastatic disease setting and the adjuvant setting. I think we got a little spoiled because we had a period in the mid-2000s where we had the approval of multiple new drugs for colorectal cancer. They all seem to be promising. And I think we've kind of plateaued right now. And we always assumed that the pace of new drug development was going to continue at the same level. There are a number of interesting agents in development. Pro-apoptotic drugs, such as the TRAIL antibody, is in clinical development. There's an interest in novel anti-angiogenesis inhibitors. I think in terms of novel adjuvant strategies, CLGB is about to open a trial looking at COX-2 inhibitors as a potential adjunct to adjuvant chemotherapy. Very provocative data from their previous studies that aspirin use after adjuvant treatment improves survival. And actually, we now routinely recommend that colorectal cancer survivors take a baby aspirin every day to try and reduce the risk of recurrence. So the COX-2 story is hypothesis-driven, and we'll look at an intermediate dose of celecoxib as an adjunct to chemotherapy. And there's a robust correlative science program built into this protocol. Another issue is how much is enough treatment? Right now, the standard of care is 6 months of 5-FU oxaliplatin. The more oxaliplatin you get, the greater the risk you're going to develop neuropathy. There was a provocative study from Great Britain published about 5 or 6 years ago where they were using 5-FU alone as an adjuvant treatment, and they compared 3 months of infusional 5-FU versus 6 months of bolus 5-FU, and they were equivalent. So actually, a truncated course of chemotherapy over 3 months had the same benefit. So now, both in Europe and the United States, as a coordinated effort, in the U.S. as part of the COX-2 trial, there is a second randomization for patients to get 3 months of adjuvant treatment versus 6 months. The 3 months versus 6 months trial is already underway in Europe, and the goal is, through international collaboration, to actually pool the two data sets so we'll be able to get a more brisk and robust answer early on about whether or not we can potentially truncate adjuvant treatment to a shorter duration.